This is Reason's Monday Morning Podcast, where top editors and writers talk about the news of last week and the news of the coming week. I'm Nick Gillespie. I'm subbing in for our regular host, Matt Welch, who is on assignment covering the Libertarian Party National Convention in New Orleans, and almost certainly be getting a bender that will probably last through the 2020 election. Please subscribe to the Reason Podcast at iTunes, Google, or wherever you want to listen to it. Wherever you do listen to it, rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Reason's editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangue Ward, Reason.com's main man, Peter Suderman, and Reason's senior editor, Damon Root, the author of 2014's Overruled, The Long War for Control of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, last week was a big week for Supreme Court-related news, so we're going to talk a lot about that today, including whether the resignation of Anthony Kennedy means the end of legal abortion in America, as some critics fear, what sort of replacement President Trump will pick, and whether we should ever rely on the Supreme Court to safeguard our liberties. We're also going to talk about last week's shooting at an Annapolis newspaper that left five people dead, and we're going to talk about Reason's 50th anniversary. Is 2018 starting to look a lot like the year of our founding, 1968, when there was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air? And we'll also talk about what we're reading, watching, chewing, and listening to. So, good morning, all.
Morning.
Hi, Nick.
Good morning.
Well, that's really good morning.
I feel
good morning.
Disproportionately
Peter,
chipper.
Can you? Well, you're the only one who's in a nice location, right? You're on vacation. I think the rest of us are in our dreary little spider holes of freedom. All right.
The sound booth is very lonely. I am very excited to find out that I've been promoted. My title's been changed from managing editor to main man.
Oh, yeah, the main man. Pretty soon you're going to be top bro or something like that. I don't know. My lingo is continuing to fade as I age. Damon, let's given all the SCOTUS news, let's start with you. You're the only person in this conversation, and if I'm wrong, please, Peter and Catherine, speak up, but I think you're the only person in this conversation who has been publicly slagged by a Supreme Court member. Remind us before we start our conversation, what was it that you wrote that Justice John Paul Stevens got all bitchy and moany about?
A few years ago, after he retired, Justice Stevens wrote a memoir of his time on the court, and I wrote a review of it for Reason.com. And I was surprised that he did not mention his majority opinion in the 2005 case of Kelo versus City of New London. That's the famous eminent domain case, which was one of the most controversial opinions he wrote in his long tenure. And so I faulted him just for not even bringing it up. And then I offered some additional criticisms of what I thought was a pretty lousy ruling. I called it the eminent domain debacle or something like that. And he happened to read that review, and he gave a speech at a law school where he sort of took a bunch of swings at me and mentioned me by name a few times and offered an even lousier defense of what was a lousy opinion to begin with.
Well, that Peter and Catherine, what Supreme Court justice would you most like to be attacked by?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, no question.
John Roberts. I'd pick John Roberts because it would be like, I mean, getting hit with a Nerf bat.
Ouch. God, I feel like we are a bunch of bitches this morning, and I am into it.
Yeah. All right. So Damon, can you lay out real quick the Janus ruling that a lot of people in kind of libertarian land were excited about? And a lot of people, certainly outside of the conservative and libertarian spheres were very upset by. What was it briefly and how big a deal?
Well, it's definitely a big deal. Back in 1977, the Supreme Court issued a ruling in a case called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education that said that state governments can impose mandatory union fees on government employees as a condition of employment, even if those employees don't join the government union. And this was justified as under sort of an economic theory of the free rider. You know, these people are getting the benefits of collective bargaining, but so they should have to pay a little something towards that. And that ruling has been around for four decades. And many states have organized their legal regimes dealing with public sector unions around it. And the Supreme Court last week in the Janus case struck it down, overruled, overturned that decision, and struck it down on First Amendment grounds, arguing that the being forced to pay the union fees was an abridgment of freedom of speech because it basically forced Janus and others like him to support union political speech that they don't agree with, and that the idea that the money was just going to collective bargaining activities, you know, that the money is fungible, and in fact it's going to all sorts of union political activity, and that forces him to speak in a way that he doesn't want to.
So here, you know, part of the question, there's about 20 states left that allow this or allowed this kind of diversion of funds. And Mark Janus, the guy who gave his name to the case, was paying about $50 every paycheck every 2 weeks to that. Is this going to actually, cut the hamstring of public sector unions, Catherine, do you think? Or is this really something that is, it's good, I guess, whenever freedom and however we define it is expanded, but is it really going to have that big an effect on anything?
You know, I always think that's a legit question when people get the kind of hysterical that they've gotten over this case, and also when libertarians get optimistic, right? So the pairing of being a libertarian and saying like, wow, this seems really good. This seems like a genuine advance in freedom of association and economic liberty. This is great. Free speech. And then also when everyone on the left is like, it's the end of the world, I just assume that actually that means nothing will change and everything will keep being bad in exactly the same way. That said, I do think,
or good
in exactly the same way. That said, I do think there'll be a decline in union membership roles in some states. I think there also was a lot of work done by the unions in the lead up to lock in collective bargaining where they could in states where it's going to now be a little more up for grabs. So I think it's going to be gradual. I think it'll be a sort of slow unfolding of a change in the union landscape that will probably be, in general, in the right direction, to my mind, which is against forced unionization. You know, there are people who want to be in unions for legit reasons. It's just that wasn't the case for Mark Janus.
Well, do you buy the, the argument that a lot of critics of public sector unionization trace back to FDR, who did say, that there shouldn't be public unions because the negotiations are fundamentally different than in the private sector, where a owner of a company or shareholders are directly working with their money, as opposed to in the public sector, where you have the negotiators are people using tax money.
I think.
I
do think that matters. I think if you buy, which I do to some extent, and as of course people always say, even Adam Smith said that, the asymmetry between employers and employees was something that could ultimately, the holders of capital and the workers could ultimately might need to be remedied with institutions. I think unions are a legitimate institution to rebalance that. And I do think it's true that public sector unions are different. I don't think it means public sector unions shouldn't exist in any form. I mean, given the whole entire corrupt statist shit show of the world that we live in, I don't know that unions are the biggest problem, but they are, I know more about this in the education sector, and in education, they are so poisonous to, to the opportunities for change. And, I think ultimately, kids are getting a sort of palpably worse education because of the fact that the general public is willing to conflate what teachers' unions want with what's good for kids, and those are not the same thing.
I think it's a challenge for unions in some real ways, and I think Catherine's probably right that the effect here will be slow and gradual rather than immediately. We're not just going to see public sector unions collapse in the next 18 months. But I do think that it's sort of telling here that people are worried that public sector unions might collapse without mandatory dues. And what that says is that nobody wants, not not nearly enough people want to be in a public sector union because they're not providing the kinds of benefits that people who might want to get. And so this in some ways is offers a sort of a challenge to public sector unions. Prove you're worth it to the people who might be paying in. If you can do that, there won't be a problem here. That is sort of one way I think of looking at this, is that if you think that this means a meltdown of public sector unions, what you're saying is the benefits there that they are providing just just don't exist and aren't worth it to most people who might plausibly benefit from them. So if they want to maintain membership, they have to provide something in return.
At the same time, I think, and this goes to Catherine's point, that it's given the large collective interests of, you know, say, teachers in a state, which, and I think in almost every state in the country, teachers are the single largest category of public sector employee. They have common interests. Their political collective bargaining power is going to be pretty strong, regardless of whether or not, you know, they're kicking in $50 or $100 a paycheck to the AFT or NEA. So I suspect this will be less earth shattering than people think. But, you know, more importantly, and Peter, let me ask you this real quick. What's your favorite movie union? Is it FIST, the Federation of Interstate Truckers from Sylvester Stallone's FIST, or is it some other imaginary union that you would like to participate
in? I don't think I've seen Sylvester Stallone's FIST. I am a big fan of
not
the,
to be confused with William Shakespeare's FIST or Federico Fellini's FIST.
I'm a big fan of Oliver Stone's Wall Street, you know, for all the wrong reasons, just as Oliver Stone didn't intend. And union membership is a big part of that movie, you know, sort of there's the older dad who's a union member, and I believe on the bargaining committee, and sort of get some inside information that the young Bud Fox uses to make his way into the upper echelons of Wall Street, sort of as his entree point. And so it's kind of an interesting example of sort of the back and forth between union bargaining and tactics and Wall Street money making.
The only correct answer here, by the way, is the all singing, all dancing union in Newsies.
I knew somebody would come up with Newsies, which is just a remarkable film, which I think is now also or was a Broadway musical starring Doogie Howser's friend and a young Christian Bale.
Fun fact.
Unionizing against Joseph Pulitzer.
Elizabeth
right?
Nolan
played
Brown.
Played by Robert Duvall.
Elizabeth Nolan Brown will fight you for the honor of Newsies. So just be aware. She's a big fan.
Okay. Now, you know, I was going to say my favorite fictional union, although I guess it's technically a guild in the Venture Brothers, the League of Calamitous Intent, which is kind of a union of supervillains, is hilarious. And it's led by David Bowie, and they have these really arcane bureaucratic rules on how you're allowed to arch-villain various superheroes. I highly recommend it. Damon, have you ever been in a union?
No. A lot of family members in the union in Michigan, though.
Oh, yeah. How are you thinking about unionizing Reason? Because now that I'm out of management,
Don't even joke about that, Gillespie. It's not even funny.
Why not? It's didn't BuzzFeed and Vice
is,
and all of these?
They're striking right now, I think. Yeah.
But wouldn't the first demand of the Reason Employees Union be the individual bargaining?
Yeah. The abolition of the union.
God, listen to these guys. I don't know if I can take
we'll
it,
about,
Damon.
We'll
you know these
this,
management people are pushing
we'll
us around.
I will bust this so, union. Want you to know.
Oh God, yeah. If anybody would hire Pinkertons, I don't even know if the Pinkertons still exist. But I suddenly see a raft of them coming down Connecticut
Plenty
Avenue.
Plenty of journalism scabs out there, friends.
Damon, the other big ruling was the Carpenter ruling. Tell us about that and why it matters.
Well, that's United States versus Carpenter. That's one of the most significant Fourth Amendment decisions in recent years. The question is, does the Fourth Amendment, which protects against, unreasonable search and seizures of your person, your papers, your effects, does that require the government to get a search warrant before it obtains, in this case, it was 127 days worth of cell phone records, cell phone metadata that was used against a suspected armed robber to trace back his whereabouts over a 4-month period and place him in the vicinity of the various crimes. And so is that a Fourth Amendment violation? Does it require a search warrant? And the government said, or the Supreme Court said, yes, it is a Fourth Amendment violation. The government generally needs a search warrant in those instances. So it's an important case in terms of just that outcome and that basic statement. But then it also is very important for sort of the future of Fourth Amendment law, where we have this thing called the third party doctrine. And that goes back to some Supreme Court cases from a few decades ago, where the court said that you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in information that you voluntarily share with third parties. So in this case, it was, well, you know, you voluntarily carry that cell phone around in your pocket. You know, it's sort of pinging off the towers, that information, that's business records you're sharing with the cell phone provider. So maybe the government doesn't need a search warrant for something like that. And the majority opinion said, you know, we're going to leave those third party doctrine precedents in place, but we're not going to extend them to this case. And so it begins to call into question the long-term validity of those precedents, which is something that a lot of civil libertarians have been arguing for some time, you know, arguing that the third party doctrine really probably didn't make any sense, you know, when it first came about, but it certainly doesn't make any sense nowadays with the advances in technology and the fact that we're all carrying like our entire, you know, everything the Fourth Amendment's about, our persons, our papers and effects, we're carrying them around in our pocket at all times. And so maybe the constitutional rule should be a little stronger against warrantless searches for that kind of information.
So you're happy about this ruling?
Yeah, I'm happy about it. And the one other thing that's interesting in the case was, so it's a 5-4 decision, and Justice Gorsuch, he dissents in the case. Mm. He writes separately. He writes a solo dissent, and then Kennedy, Alito, and Thomas are part of a dissent of their own. And the Kennedy, Alito, Thomas dissent says, listen, this is a clear third-party doctrine case. Of course the government can do this, get this kind of information. And in fact, the Supreme Court's ruling today is going to hamstring law enforcement. It's going to, you know, interfere with, you know, all sorts of vital police needs and so forth. And what Gorsuch says in his dissent is, well, you know, these third party doctrine cases really don't make a lot of sense, and it's really time to revisit them. But because that issue wasn't directly before the court, he didn't feel that he had a judicial obligation not to then, you know, sort of issue a ruling on something that wasn't directly before the court. So instead, he basically writes his dissent inviting future cases, telling all the, you know, enterprising Fourth Amendment lawyers out there and people at the ACLU and stuff like that, like, listen, bring me one of these cases. You've got at least one vote to overturn, or at least to really question the third party doctrine in detail. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, she feels that way also. So it sort of sends the signal for future cases in a good future direction.
How does that play out in your theory of kind of the awfulness of judicial restraint, which for a long time was a conservative calling card, you know, that judges shouldn't make laws, they should merely, you know, enforce majority will on everybody. Are you happy with Gorsuch there, or is he problematic because he didn't say, you know, fuck it, like, yeah, this isn't exactly before the court, but I could join the majority and say, yeah, let's move up the speed to which we go against the
Fourth Amendment. If there was a need for a fifth vote in this case, Gorsuch probably would have concurred and said, well, I concur in the judgment, but just not in the way the result was reached. And we've seen Justice Thomas do that in cases. So I think precisely because the win was already there for Carpenter, he used this opportunity to kind of write for the future and dissent. And I think that's a totally appropriate thing for a justice to do. And we've seen Thomas, for example, a bunch of years ago in concurrence and dissent, calling out issues like the Second Amendment, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, campaign finance regulation, basically saying, like, there's some real problems here. It'd be great if somebody could bring us one of those cases. He's done that recently with civil asset forfeiture. So there's a record of this kind of thing working. And because, you know, if you want a landmark constitutional ruling, you do want the case teed up appropriately. And so that invites the enterprising lawyers out there to do that. So I think that's, you know, in terms of the stance in this case, I don't have a problem with that.
I've got to tell you, I mean, the Supreme Court is getting more boring than Archer, the animated series on FX, and I'm not sure I can stick with it for a couple more seasons. I would have rather have seen this plot development right now. But Peter, you write a lot about medicine and healthcare. There's a place where privacy or the expectation of privacy and ownership seems to be shifting radically. Privacy is clearly a very plastic notion that changes depending on technology and kind of social attitudes. It's not, you know, it's not an element that we find in nature or anything. Do you where do you see this kind of like third party doctrine, maybe, you know, not in police cases or anything, but these issues of privacy intersecting with health insurance, health records?
So first of all, I think that there are some loopholes in the ruling. You know, it's there. It doesn't count. It potentially doesn't count against record searches that are less than 7 days. It's actually pretty easy to judge shop and to gin up probable cause and get a warrant. Second of all, I think just sort of even more broadly than the healthcare issue, but somewhat on that front, the third party doctrine, that the idea that you lose your privacy as soon as you share your information with any other sort of profession, with any other service, is an idea that I think really we need to be reconsidering. The idea, because basically what it says is that no paid service can serve as your agent. And so think of, say that we, sort of a good way to think about this is with how lawyers work and how lawyers are granted confidentiality. They cannot be forced to turn over information that you've told them with a few narrow exceptions. And so in the same way that when you share your information with Amazon, with a bank, with a medical provider, we really need to be kind of thinking of these as extensions of the self, because the idea and as extensions of your person, because the whole idea of, you know, that your person is protected, but as soon as you share with any other service, is just really kind of outdated. And it's based on a model of privacy and personal information and records keeping that doesn't exist anymore and is increasingly not going to exist.
Well, do you, by the same token, you know, one of the things, Catherine, we're talking about here is that a lot of the times the way that I feel anyway, because I don't, I'm stumbling over my words right now because I don't really understand law anyway, but, you know, it's also what we're talking about here is that just that the cops have to get a warrant anyway. It's not like, oh, because you shared something, you know, you shared data with Amazon, that the cops can't actually get a, you know, or with a third party, they can get a warrant when they have sufficient evidence, which seems kind of like, why are we even discussing this at this late stage in, you know, in human history?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, sort of a joke, right? The sort of punchline to the libertarian dad joke is, you know, got a warrant. And I think, you know, it's fair to make fun of that a little bit, not least because I think that the average American really doesn't know that you don't need a warrant in so many circumstances, that there is still so much loosey-goosiness in the law around around information like this. And, you know, I think on the flip side, it's important to have formal safeguards like, you know, the process of obtaining a warrant. At the same time, you know, the issuers of warrants are not always as rigorous as your friendly neighborhood libertarian would like. And, you know, we see that in all different kinds of courts, but that basically for too many judges, warrant issuance is basically a rubber stamp. And so even if we established that everywhere and always, it wouldn't mean that people's privacy is appropriately protected. There's still a whole bunch of other layers that need to be put on top.
And there are some incentives here that counteract the usefulness of this, which is that the more warrants are required, the more likely more judges will be to just rubber stamp everything rather than actually pay attention to it, because they will just it as, well, there's a flood of warrants, warrant requests coming in today, and so I need to get through these. These things happen all the time. This is not something that I really need to seriously consider.
Have any three of you changed your Facebook habits or Gmail habits in the wake of, you know, recent revelations that, you know, none of these online services that we use all the time and for free really are either, you know, completely porous or shitty when it comes to working with law enforcement, or, you know, just being hacked? I mean, has anybody actually changed how they
I've started posting my credit card number and social security number in my Twitter bio. Just get it over with. No, I actually did I did deactivate my Facebook account. It's still sort of there, but dormant. There's no messages to me. No one can find me. But that had basically nothing to do with privacy concerns and much more to do with the fact that I just didn't find it very useful or productive to be on Facebook anymore.
I continue to be... Oh, go ahead, Damon.
Damon, what about you? Oh, yeah. No, I feel like Damon has a lot to say about Facebook. I don't know. You know, those rants about unionizing reason, it's like filling up. Well, it's a private group, so I guess I shouldn't be talking about it in public.
I'm typing that. I sign into Facebook once every few months. I find it depressing and usually go away again. So, I have little to say about it.
I'm like more Catholic than the Pope on the Declan McCullough upsides of zero privacy thesis. I think at this point he's gone sort of squishy and is like, well, you know, maybe we were overly sanguine about how wide open the floodgates would be between private and public. I do worry about that, but I still think we sort of socially and in these types of discussions systematically underestimate how incredibly valuable it is to us for every Tom, Dick, and Harry who wants to sell us stuff to have all of our information. I feel great joy when I see targeted ads, and I recognize that makes me atypical, but I think it's easy to forget what it was like to live in a world with one size fits all advertising and content arrangement. And I think people really don't appreciate it. You know, as we're redesigning reason.com. And one thing that I've really kind of been blown away by is how sophisticated their tools there are for showing people the content that we think they're going to like, and we're going to use them. And that requires people to share their information with us. And, they do explicitly consent, but how many people really understand what that means? How many people really understand how that interacts with the law? I think it's very minimal. But, you know, when we relaunch reason.com and you go on there and see a bunch of articles that you're stoked to read, it's not because you're lucky. It's because, you know, we have these information sharing practices and we have good technologies to take advantage of them.
So, Catherine, I'm with you, and we've talked about this a number of times before. Targeted ads are... I don't want to say they're great, but they're kind of great, and they're certainly better than the alternative. But the worry for me isn't targeted ads. It's that when companies become so large that they have a kind of quasi-monopoly power, and then in order to keep that power, they basically team up with the government in order to become, let's say, semi-public utilities or sort of de facto public utilities. And so to me,
so you're talking about what
with Facebook,
Facebook or
whatever other large
during the
company,
hearings basically
large,
said,
tech company.
Yep.
And the worry is that bigness isn't bad on its own, and it's not that what's Facebook going to do with my information? They're going to try and sell me some shoes or something, right? But the worry isn't what Facebook is going to do with the information. The worry is what the government is going to do with the information that I've shared with Facebook, with the information that Facebook has collected on millions, tens of millions of Americans and others.
So fill that nightmare out.
I worry, as I think most libertarians do, about what happens when the government gets access to extremely effectively collected mass information on its citizens. And for all of the reasons that we wouldn't want the government going and collecting that information on its own, we should be at least a little bit worried about the government getting access to that information through a very effective information gathering company like Facebook.
So I agree with all that, but I also think that, you know, people like you signing out of Facebook, and you know, and this is a documented phenomenon that, people don't have to have a sophisticated understanding of the legal and privacy issues to know that there's a little bit of a stink on that company now. And I agree that as long as government is big and intrusive, companies that are as big as Facebook will try to use government to protect their monopoly. But I also think the exit option is stronger with even the most politically connected private company, and people can and do exercise it. So, yeah, I'm, I mean, I We agree.
Let's continue this conversation on Gab, right? The the right wing alternative.
Yeah, I'll see y'all on Gab this afternoon.
This doesn't quite go to the immediate conversation, but I think it's there somewhat in that, you know, when changes in privacy, where things that were private now can be made public against the will of people, our kind of social attitudes change. And I actually read about this about 10 or 15, almost 15 years ago, about in the context of sex tapes, where sex tapes of celebrities were enough to destroy careers. Rob Lowe went through one. There was a TV anchor, sportscaster named Jane Kennedy, who is often considered to have the first celebrity sex tape, like a VHS tape leaked. And it hurt her career. It's not clear that it killed it because it was already on the skids. But it seems to me that one of the things, like nude photos of, you know, Madonna or whoever, and actually up until Madonna, that could really hurt you. Vanessa Williams lost in the 80s, I guess, lost the Miss America crown because this was seen as scandalous behavior. Now it is not, because people understand that private things become public and they chill out about it. Damon, do you think there's a sense that with some of, you know, we live in a world where Harvey Silverglate and others talk about how we're committing 3 felonies a day, et cetera. Will the government and will law enforcement ultimately have to concede, kind of like, you know, if they have access to everybody's private information and, you know, the people's drug buying habits on Facebook groups and things like that, that they're going to stop enforcing a lot of laws that are, you know, everybody is breaking. Is there a way here that this can be good when the private becomes public, regardless of questions about the Fourth Amendment or consent?
I think I'm probably less optimistic on that front. I mean, I assume that if there's something is on the criminal books and it can be used against someone who maybe you're after them for some other reason, that's a charge you can tack on and use as a bargaining chip, as a way to, you know, force somebody to plead out or something like that. So I
guess what I'm asking, I get that, but would it be possible to, or is it possible to conceive of or push for a world where, you know, we simplify the law, then we make fewer things illegal? I guess I don't know what's in my coffee this morning, because I'm acting as if, you know, common sense dictates the growth and accretion of laws over time. But, you know, so you're pessimistic about this.
Well, I mean, I take the point that changing social attitudes, if they're changed in the right direction, then law and other things will follow in the wake. So I guess I'm not seeing evidence of enough of the changing social attitudes at the moment to be optimistic. But I can imagine the scenario.
Well, so to talk about pessimism, let's talk about Anthony Kennedy and his legacy. Kennedy's retiring at the end of the month, and Donald Trump has pledged to name his replacement by July 9th and get the nominee confirmed before the midterms, which will be interesting. And Trump is, I hate to say it, but he might be winning so much that we're getting tired of winning. But he stays to his word at The New Yorker. And I want to read a passage from Jeffrey Toobin's absolutely apocalyptic story about what happens now that Kennedy is going to leave the court at the end of the month. He talked about how Kennedy was big on human dignity and moderation, but he predicts, Jeffrey Toobin, and this is very characteristic of a lot of critiques I've seen, the Supreme Court will overrule Roe v. Wade, allowing states to ban abortions, to criminally prosecute any physicians and nurses who perform them. It will allow shopkeepers, restaurateurs, and hotel owners to refuse service to gay customers on religious grounds. It will guarantee that fewer African-American and Latino students attend elite universities. It will approve laws designed to hinder voting rights. It will sanction execution by grotesque means. It will invoke the Second Amendment to prohibit states from engaging in gun control, including the regulation of machine guns and bump stocks. Catherine, are you willing to help me rock Jeffrey Toobin asleep Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and we'll find somebody else to do the rest of the week?
So I think like the verb choices in there are the most interesting part to me. The idea that there's this kind of totally inevitable slide into the liberals' caricature of what the right wants in America. You know, I think this is actually going to be a really interesting period for questions about federalism, because if anything, what this court is going to do, and it, you can hear that actually lurking in that passage that you just read, even though he uses words like guarantee, you know, it's that actually, for the most part, what it's going to be is the court will open the door a bit wider to letting states do some of those things. And some of those states might take up the court on some of those points sometimes, maybe. And that's a really different thing than, you know, what I think most people hear when they hear repeal of Roe v. Wade, which is abortion banned everywhere forever. Or when they hear invoke the Second Amendment, they hear every gun legal everywhere forever. And that's not what's going to happen. That is definitely not what's going to happen. You know, that said, I do think the specific choice of justice, it matters a lot more than the catastrophizers are saying as well, right? Like Trump could pick someone who would just like shove the court pretty hard in the nightmare direction of that piece. He could easily pick someone who's you know, very restrained. And, you know, over the course of the next two decades, some of those things will happen.
What, Damon, how would you sum up Kennedy's profile, like his legacy? Because in that Tubin piece and elsewhere, people point out, you know, he was behind Citizens United. He was behind a bunch of cases that liberals and, you know, I love the phrase, Catherine, the catastrophizers. Because when Citizens United, you know, was passed, which allowed corporations to engage in, you know, free in political speech before elections or help to grease those wheels, everybody was like, you know, our democracy is over. And somehow, you know, we've survived somewhat. But Damon, how do you characterize Kennedy from a libertarian perspective? Because he's good on gay rights. He's pretty good on free speech. He was good on Citizens United, certainly. But he's no bed of roses, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first things from the libertarian perspective you say about Kennedy is that he joined John Paul Stevens' majority opinion in Kelo, which we were talking about earlier. He joined John Paul Stevens' majority opinion in Gonzales v. Raich, which was the medical marijuana federalism case, both that same term. So,
God, you are really obsessed with John Paul Stevens. Can you let him go?
As long as he walks the earth, I will hound him.
I'm on Stevens' side. Yeah. Are you like going through his garbage still and, you know, finding weird tidbits and posting them on your Facebook account?
This is the greatest feud of this millennium.
I just had the clearest mental image.
No comment.
I just had the clearest mental image of Damon Root dressed as a raccoon going through Supreme Court justice garbage. So everyone enjoy that.
Rocket raccoon.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with a little adult cosplay.
Yeah. Well, there's going to be, though. It's going to be against the law. That's the part of Tubin's article.
It's going to be left to the state for the
states.
Know,
some
to
states
decide.
Will be.
No. But I want to hear Damon pronounce on is Kennedy a libertarian? Because I have had this conversation with about 45 people in the last 4 days, and I want to be smarter when I answer it. And so, Damon, tell me what I think.
Well, the New York Times reporter from the New York Times a few years ago asked Kennedy or said to Kennedy, you know, people call you libertarian. What do you make of that? And he said, yeah, people say that about me a lot, but I don't know what it means. And I think most libertarians would agree with him on that. You know, so I'd say that. But if you take the broadest view of his judicial career, you can see that this is the one member of the Supreme Court in the last couple decades who has maintained your basic, very general libertarian mix of being socially liberal and then a little more, you know, fiscally conservative, if we want to use that unfortunate definition of libertarian. But then when you drill down in the details, you know, you find all these examples where he's not that. I think that he pushed the court in a more libertarian direction in many instances, but then obviously the opposite in others. I mean, everything about his jurisprudence is frustrating, and everyone who followed the court, whether on the left, the right, I mean, basically like every political faction in America was furious at him at some point and was disappointed. They felt like he was on his side and then he let them down. So you can see he's good on property rights in some cases. And then, whoa, there's Kelo. You know, he was a very strong voice in federalism cases in a number of them. And yet there he was in Gonzales v. Raich.
So he is libertarian,
yeah.
Right? That Larry King defined libertarian as saying, you know, that half the time people disagree with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, he managed to annoy everyone. So
he's pissing
everybody. Yeah, he shares that with libertarians for sure. You know, I think that you can say that, you know, he was in a broad sense, libertarian-ish on some issues, but not on others. But because of the way the court was configured, and just sort of the happenstance of history, and he happens to be the right man in the right place, so he's this fifth vote in so many of these cases. I mean, that's really that's really his influence. Because the court had been shaped differently, he may have just been just another justice and not the one who every lawyer pitched every argument to. I will say that his rulings in gay rights, I think that's going to be his greatest legacy. I think that's his libertarian, to the extent that there's a libertarian theme in his jurisprudence, it's the strongest there. And I would point to Lawrence versus Texas, the 2003 ruling that strikes down Texas's ban on called the Homosexual Conduct Act ban on same-sex relations. And that decision, the outcome is obviously something libertarians cheered, but also the way Kennedy approached that, the argument and Justice Scalia's dissent in that case was like, listen, this is the police powers of the states, this is morals legislation, the state governments get total deference in this area, this is just something that we just presume what they're doing, it's perfectly lawful, and it's, and then there's really no reason to second guess the legislatures. And what Kennedy kind of flipped that, and he said, we start with a presumption that these persons have an individual right, and that the state has to actually show that it has a legitimate, health, welfare, public safety purpose for these kind of regulations. And the state kind of failed miserably in the oral arguments to do that. It basically kept coming down to sort of a disapproval of same-sex couples. And that under the kind of analysis that Kennedy was using was like, you're basically treating a class of people unfairly, you're not recognizing a broad liberty. This is sort of the state's power to reach into the bedroom is actually not unlimited under the 14th Amendment. And so I think that you can see some aspects of what the libertarian legal movement is calling for in that case. Certainly not in others, but that's sort of the one I think that is the best example of it.
Peter, do you worry about abortion rights being chipped away? I don't even know. And I, we've been working together since, I think, the second Monroe administration. But are you pro-abortion or anti-abortion?
I probably am best described as conflicted. If you look at the opinion polls on abortion, Americans basically think, well, I don't know, it doesn't seem like a great idea to have it sort of, it makes me quite uncomfortable to have it legal at, basically at all times. On the other hand, I really wouldn't want to just sort of, wouldn't want to make it illegal for basically everyone everywhere, and exactly where the line is or what the exceptions are. There's no real clear consensus. People are fairly muddled in their thinking. And I think I am one of those people. Is probably the best way to describe me. I would have described myself as quite strongly pro-life in my youth, and I have become less certain of my own ability to make less clear on what I think as I have grown a little bit older. Though I guess I would say I sort of still have. I would like to be pro-life, and I find it hard to be pro-life practically. Is maybe a different way of putting it. I don't know whether I worry too much about the end of Roe. I think that it is possible, however. Let me put it this way. I think that it is unlikely that we are going to see in the next couple of years Roe overturned completely. However, what I have heard from folks in the kind of legal world who follow this stuff much more closely than I do is that the assumption is that the replacement for Kennedy will not be the swing vote on the court, and instead that role will move to Chief Justice John Roberts. And Roberts is, in many ways, he's probably sympathetic to the two pro-life arguments, but he's also really an incrementalist, someone who likes broad, who likes to get a large majority for a narrow ruling. That is his ideal outcome. And so the thinking is that the Roberts court will not overturn Roe, but chip it away just a little. And I don't know exactly what that means, but I suspect...
Although Trump Trump did campaign on, you know, and obviously the guy's known to shoot his mouth off a bit, but he explicitly said that he would appoint chief or Supreme Court justices who would overturn.
Right, but if there's four, but imagine that there are that the court it looks like it does right now, and there are and that the replacement for Kennedy is strongly pro-life and is basically comes in, says day one, makes an announcement, I will overturn Roe the first opportunity I get. That's still four conservative votes, I think, for overturning Roe. And then what about Chief Justice Roberts? What does he do? Does he come sign on to totally overturning it? Or does he say, I'm not going to sign on to that, but what we're going to do is we're going to make, you know, sort of chip away at it. We're going to take little bits at it. We're going to sort of restrict and restrain that ruling, which a lot of legal experts who are even pro-choice think was kind of badly decided and wasn't well thought through just from a legal perspective. And so I think that that is reasonably possible. But as Catherine said, that wouldn't simply ban abortion the day that the ruling goes into effect. The effect it would have would be to return that to the states. And so it is possible then that we would have illegal abortion in some states, but it wouldn't be that we would have no abortion anymore in America.
Catherine, do you like, you know, and this is, you know, when we talk about, you know, and a lot of this I'm getting from my misreading, my deliberate misreading of Damon's book, Overruled. But, you know, the idea is that the court should actively strike down laws that, you know, impinge on our essential rights. How do you, when you're thinking about this, you know, like what, how do you know what's an essential right and what is something that actually majority should be allowed to vote on? And then where does abortion or reproductive rights more broadly, and maybe by conflating those two things, I'm already trying to game the answer here. But how do you make that determination when you think about issues like that for where you want the Supreme Court to be super libertarian and say, no, you know what, these are rights that no government can alienate us from?
I'm going to give a moderately douchey answer to that question and say two things. The first is that if I am...
By the way, moderately douchey is a whole new axe line that's coming out in the fall.
I saw that in the Rite Aid last week.
Lady axe.
Yeah, for the moderately douchey club goer.
Is it a pink axe?
So first of all, I'm basically, if I am anything, I am something like a rule-based consequentialist. So I think that people need the sense that rules are real and important and that actually leads to the best outcomes, that if people try to be consequentialist, they make bad decisions. So I see rights like that. I think it's good for people to believe that they're real. Noble lie stuff is obviously deeply problematic. And moderately douchey.
God, you know, it's like you've never left the Weekly Standard.
What do you want from me? And so I think that what I like is,
you know, that doesn't make it okay. That's like, I'm going to kill you. That doesn't make it right. You know,
I like
just that you announce it.
I like it when courts, when judges act like they have a sort of deeply principled stance where they are looking to either, you know, originalism or to whatever version of legal theory they want. I think that leads to better outcomes. At the same time, I think mostly what courts do are get to the policy outcomes that they want. That there's lots of window dressing around it, but that's more or less what happens. So I'm not, I guess this is all by way of saying, I think it would be good if abortion was broadly legal, because I think it would be good if almost everything was broadly legal. But I also think that it is an understandable compromise in the world if the place we devolve that decision to is lower than the level of the federal government. And I don't think that, you know, I think it's just a case of competing goods. I don't think it's a case of, you know, where some kind of inherent rights theory lives.
I would also sort of, I would add to that just a little bit, which is that, you know, describing my own muddled thinking as kind of tracking the public's muddled thinking, overturning Roe and returning that decision to the states would allow, frankly, for a kind of more muddled law when it comes to abortion, one that tracked the public's opinion somewhat better. But
the public isn't actually muddled. The large majority of people like abortion laws the way they are.
That's basically when you ask people, do you like Roe, which guarantees the right to abortion, which to most people reads as, do you like a, the, do you think abort, if most people will understand that as overturning Roe would mean abortion is illegal. And when you poll, when you do surveys that tell people that that's not the case and ask people what their ideal is, it becomes much more confused or it becomes much more mushy.
I agree. But I mean, very few people say, you know, and part of what Roe did was really kind of instantiate a trimester, you know, kind of frame on the way we talk about abortion. But most people are good with allowing abortion to be widely available in the first,
and
you know,
12 states
weeks
could
of,
make those decisions. And my point is that what this might do is it could have the effect, not wouldn't necessarily, but could have the effect of cooling down this issue politically and making it less of a, I mean, like we have, like, this is a thing that happens in presidential debates right now,
is that candidates
are asked, well, how would you, what do you think about abortion? And like President Trump, yes, of course, can nominate pro-choice or pro-life judges to the Supreme Court, but doesn't rule on, like, he doesn't make abortion policy himself. And so, but we get hung up on this and we spend an awful lot of kind of our national political discussion is focused on this. And what this would do would be to partially, at least, I think, take it out of the realm of federal policy discussion. And hopefully, I think it would sort of cool the politics of abortion. Not that everyone would be happy with it. That's not what I'm saying, but that it could sort of have it could unheat some of the political.
Cool. Yes. We have a word for that.
Well, I said cool like so many times that I was just trying to it could turn down the temperature, the weather in Washington today.
Damon, can you imagine a world, can you imagine like a Supreme Court ruling that would return some kind of legal control to the states where you would get, you know, screwed by that? Or you would feel like, hey, you know what? I've got an inalienable right here. And you've just said that now I might be living in a state where I'm not allowed to do this, that, or the other thing that I should absolutely be allowed to as a condition of being in the United States. I mean, I guess these are all just their arguments with no clear dividing lines and things like that. But, you know, why would we not put up with a state laws that ban free speech, but we're willing to say, you know, let's return abortion to the states? How do you make those distinctions?
Well, I mean, that's the whole, you know, theory and argument for the 14th Amendment and why it was added to the Constitution, which was to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. When the Constitution was originally ratified, the Bill of Rights did not apply to them. And the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. It doesn't say anything about state governments. So the 14th Amendment does that. And the idea there is that there are rights of U.S. citizenship that you carry with you everywhere you go. And that was a change to the American system of federalism. Doesn't entirely overturn it, but does change it dramatically. So the question that courts should be looking at is this the type of right that deserves protection under the 14th Amendment or not? I can tell you that lots of Second Amendment advocates do not prefer the return it back to the states view for gun rights, which they would like to see the Second Amendment enforced in New York City just as strongly as it's enforced in Bozeman, Montana, or something, and see restrictions on concealed carry struck down. And that's a national interpretation. The idea is it's a national right. And that's a national interpretation of that right. So I think that it's very easy for everybody of whatever political side of the political spectrum you're on to imagine a scenario where you would like to see a fundamental right enforced in all 50 states. There's just this big fight about, you know, which rights count and why and how much local conditions should matter.
Right. So what about abortion? I'm putting you on the spot. I'm putting you on the spot right now. Damon Root, a leader of the proto-union movement at Reason and Reason.com, Reason TV. Maybe Reason Foundation, and those guys are kind of wishy-washy. They'll roll over. But, I mean, is there an inherent right under the American Constitution to access to abortion?
Well, I think there's two ways to approach the abortion question, and the way the court has done it is under...
Did you hear this? Did you hear what that is, Peter and Catherine? That is somebody not answering.
That's well-informed nuance. Yes. Let the man
talk. We are going to hear an awful lot of that when the confirmation hearings start.
Yeah.
Well, the court has done it under the idea of a right to privacy. So it's a right. But one of the things that's left out of this is the argument about the government power, which is the flip side of it. So you talk only about rights. You also miss the idea that the state governments need to justify the restriction. And is this count as a legitimate exercise of state's police power? And you can go back to the founding era and you see that abortion is largely unregulated up to a point called the quickening. And maybe that matches with the first trimester business in Roe. Maybe it doesn't. So there needs to be, I think, if we're going to go back to the drawing board on this issue, as opposed to just work within the Roe and then Casey versus Planned Parenthood framework, which is the undue burden test, you actually want to talk about what are the legitimate police powers of the states, and what do the states have? What kind of affirmative showing do they need to make for every regulation? So not just abortion regulations, but all sorts of regulations as it advance the public health, welfare, or safety. And you get to a
and this has come up, if I can just point out, in places like Texas and Virginia, where laws or proposed laws have been saying things like, well, abortion clinics need to basically be hospitals. Because they, you know, in a weird way, given, you know, the fact that liberals who tend to like heavy regulation of small businesses, when it came to abortion, they were like, hey, you know what? Abortion clinics can be a lot less regulated than typical medical facilities. And the courts have, you know, said you can't just say, OK, you've got to widen the hallways and you have to have instant access to hospital rights, et cetera, as a way to make it harder for women to get abortion.
Well, yeah, that was the, you know, the issue before the Supreme Court in Whole Woman's Health versus Texas, and those restrictions are struck down. So I think that in the near term, there's a good chance that the justice who replaces Kennedy is going to be someone who's more inclined to uphold those kind of regulations. It does depend on the nominee, and we don't know who that is yet. And then, you know, these people, they get life tenure, they get on the Supreme Court, things can change too. And you find out in their heart of hearts where they actually really come down in terms of chipping away at Roe or not. Because there are a lot of elected Republicans on Capitol Hill who are, you know, screaming to their constituents about how much they hate abortion and they hate Roe v. Wade, but in their heart of hearts, they don't believe that. And that was true with gay marriage and gay rights, where now you see less anti-gay sentiment coming from some Republicans where there was lots of it, and Democrats as well. But I do think that that's the more likely scenario. I mean, Roe is not going to be overturned, you know, in the next 18 months or something like that. But there is the chance it will be overturned eventually, depending on the justice and the direction of the court. But it's certainly cases like those sorts of burdensome regulations out of Texas and issues like that. Those kind of things are probably more likely to survive in the future.
Yeah, and well, maybe it'll be like the way we're talking about the Janus ruling, where it will, you know, the effect is going to. But, you know, and I guess this isn't. I was going to say it's not a bad thing that things happen incrementally. It really depends on what's happening and where you are and, you know, the way things are changing, I suppose. Let us now talk about, to move off of the Supreme Court, the Annapolis Capital Gazette, a newspaper, had its offices shot up and five people killed there by a crazed gunman. Peter, do you feel this was a lot of people were talking about journalists? You know, journalists have been demonized under President Trump in a way that is pretty, you know, pretty profound. I mean, he talks a lot about liars, et cetera. It's clear that the gunman had, you know, he had a personal axe to grind and he was insane. But do you feel like there's any connection between kind of general rhetoric and specific actions like this? We see that, you know, we hear this a lot, you know, that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald who killed Kennedy. It was the rhetoric of hate in Dallas, et cetera. Do you worry at all about being a journalist?
If the question is, did Donald Trump cause or influence in a measurable way this shooting, then yeah. I think the answer is no. The alleged shooter had a grudge against this paper going back far before Trump had even started his campaign, and was clearly someone who was just not entirely there, had violent tendencies, and erupted in a really sad and tragic way here. And I don't think it had anything to do with Donald Trump. If the question is Donald Trump helping to create an environment, helping to legitimize a quite deep and perhaps verging on violent environments against journalists in some cases, helping to stoke some of the anger that existed against basically with the elite media or what is perceived as elite media that existed before Trump again was even started his campaign. I think the answer is in some ways yes. And you saw, you know, at Trump's campaign rallies, him talking, first of all, he would say things like, well, you know, if there's a protester, you can punch them and I'll pay your legal bills, right? So kind of basically saying violence is okay if it's in support of me. And then you also see have seen rallies.
I'll pay your pay your legal bills, right? He said
you've also
the,
seen
rallies,
pretty aggressive confrontations, not exactly violent, but aggressive confrontations between reporters and people at Trump rallies and at sort of more kind of conservative events usually surrounding Trump. Mm-hmm. And so Trump is changing that environment. He's not, however, making this shooting happen, I think, and trying. And so it's really necessary to split those two ideas apart and say that, well, Trump is not good for a free press and for support of free inquiry and journalism. He's also not responsible in any way that I can see for the shooting and for that horrible incident last week.
I agree with that, Catherine. Catherine, do you worry at all that, you know, whether it's Trump or other people, you know, because what was it a year ago when Steve Scalise, you know, got shot by another crazed gunman? I mean, a congressman at a baseball practice. Do you worry at all that it's not that aggregate violence is maybe increasing, but, you know, Trump has a very violent rhetoric. And the country in general seems to be more willing to put up with that. Like various people are saying, yeah, you know, maybe the president shouldn't be such a fucking asshole all the time. It's kind of like, no, let's do it with him. Do you worry at all? You know, and I'm thinking about this in terms of Reason Magazine 50th anniversary. We started in 1968, which is widely seen as one of those years where violence erupted in America in a way that really kind of cracked the American century. Do you have concerns at all about just the general way we are talking to each other?
I mean, I have long been an advocate for the no, it is not worse than ever line. And I think that holds here. I'm much more worried about bad policy toward the press than I am about violence and also in general bad policy toward all Americans. You know, we ran a book review in the last issue by Reason's own Brian Doherty. And, you know, the headline that we put on it was 1972, the year that made 2018 seem sane. And the book is mostly about Richard Nixon's, you know, long battle with Timothy Leary. Which is
public enemy number
utterly
one.
Yeah. Bananas. Like I maybe I'm just too young. I really did not understand the extent of the sort of personal vendetta with the full power of the state turned, you know, internationally toward the pursuit of this dude who just like had a couple of joints in his suitcase. And like, I guess I think I take solace
oh,
in...
Oh, come on. Leary was the revolutionary. He was running Trans Love Airlines. He was going to turn the world into his own personal pleasure palace. Of course, Nixon had to go out.
I take solace in the batshittery of Richard Nixon when I think about our current predicament.
So you prefer... You like Trump. Trump might be bad, but he's no Nixon.
I mean, he's no Nixon yet. Let's leave it there.
But, well, do you think, I mean, you know, and this is something, and I you know, Charles Krauthammer died recently. I remember one conversation I actually had with him. This was years ago at the Slate office, and he was like, you know, violent TV. But as soon as he heard I was a libertarian, he started, you know, like, oh, I used to be a libertarian. Then I, you know, got, I had puberty or something. And then he was like, you know, violent TV and video games are causing violence. And I was like, you know, actually, all the crime rates are down. This was in the early 2000s. And he was like, well, it's coarsening the culture. And I was like, yeah, well, who fucking cares? But maybe we should care.
Personally, saying who fucking cares to coarsening the culture to Charles Krauthammer is pretty great.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's, you know, the tendency, the temptation of golden ageism is everywhere and always. And that... I actually think maybe due to the labors of Steven Pinker or maybe others, that I see more and more people sort of grokking this idea that the world is safer and more plentiful and allows people to be themselves. You know, it can those ideas can sit together in our minds. The idea is that, like, it's a real tragedy that that this local newsroom was shot up or that Charlottesville happened. And also that for most people in the United States, the world is better and better. Like, it's a tough thing to convey as an editorial line, for instance. But I think it is a thing that lots of people are able to hold in their minds.
I would say, though, that, I mean, yeah, since Damon, Nick brought up the coarsening of the culture in violent movies and video games, there's a real big difference in my mind between violent movies and video games what's coming from the White House and from our elected officials. And again, this goes back to the difference between, you know, the private power of Facebook to sell me more ads, to sell me better shoes and to sort of deliver better ads, and the power of the government to do whatever it is the government is going to do with the information it collects. And the sort of public-private distinction to me seems to be pretty important. I think violent movies and video games are, if anything, a clear net win for our society. They're entertaining as hell half the time, and there seems to be pretty decent evidence that they're actually helping to restrain violence by giving people an outlet. I don't think that's the case when we see this stuff coming from public officials, especially people as powerful and with as big a platform as the President of the United States.
Don't you think, though, that the Charles Krauthammers of the world could easily make the case, like, Donald Trump is the proof of their point, right? This is someone who emerged swamp creature-like from our coarsened popular culture, you know, from reality TV, and, you know, rose to take over our politics. I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I guess I am sympathetic to people who say, as culture becomes more powerful and pervasive and also sort of trashier, the rise of Donald Trump was if not inevitable, at least consequence of it.
Yeah, Damon, as somebody who was into loud rock music in your younger days, maybe Trump is just, you know, he's telling it like it is. And, you know, just like Public Enemy or whoever would talk about 911 as a joke, Trump's just calling bullshit. And we should always be on the side of the bullshit callers rather than the you know, the blue nose patrollers of all that is good and decent. And who wants to go back to some fucking Senate where Robert Byrd is going on and, you know, fake Senateese about how wonderful it is to work with all of these know nothing idiots that surround him, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I can only imagine what Chuck D would say, that Donald Trump is his spiritual offspring. I look forward to that Public Enemy track. Well, you know, I mean, I think that the point that it's that this is that, that things have been worse before, and America's gone through some really contentious political periods. You know, you have Woodrow Wilson locking up his critics in federal prison, and Congress letting him do it, passing laws letting him do it, and they lead up to the Civil War. You know, Charles Sumner being almost, you know, beaten to death on the Senate floor. I mean, so we're not there, obviously. So maybe some of the apocalypse can be dialed down. I do. I mean, it may be just my experience, but as someone who doesn't slot into certainly either political party, but also either broad political persuasion, I find this a very challenging time. I think that it's the political polarization seems very strong. There's very strong kind of political tribalism going on. I mean, I'm interested in hearing what your experiences with this are. But I mean, to me, there's a lot of ugly rhetoric. I wouldn't mind a little more civility, to use that kind of old-fashioned word, but people actually just being a little more sincere and disagreeing sincerely without so many cheap shots and so much kind of posturing. So, I find it kind of an ugly moment. I don't think I think that culture can matter, but then at the same time, you know, don't blame the culture for individual acts of violence. But I mean, I do think the culture does have a, you know, does matter.
I do want to note the latest advocate of civility, just a piece that just went live this morning at Reason's site. The Unite the Right organizer, Kessler, sued a woman who called him a crybaby and said fuck you to him in court and won, although he asked for $500 in damages and got $5 in damages. But he explained that the goal of this rally having white nationalist was, you know, he wanted to make a point about the importance of civility. So
yeah, and to be clear, I want to say I'm in favor of saying fuck you to white nationalists, and you know, not to be against that.
You know what? Stop with the virtue section.
I'm just making. I would like to make the point that in terms of political disagreements that we have, and media professionals, politicians, you know, the people that are the ones that a lot of people are opening the newspapers and reading the editorial, and for better or worse, and usually for worse, getting, you know, the talking points for the day to argue with their family members. You know, since I don't fit into either of the easy camps, you know, I don't have an interest in demonizing either side so dramatically. And you know, so to the extent that that's happening in such, seems like a very widespread sort of way, you know, I'm giving that a little, you know, signal of disapproval.
Well, one of the questions of, you know, that I've been mulling over for a while now is, like, clearly we need like a reset or a reboot, a reiteration, not, you know, not a complete, you know, tear down and new operating system or something. But it's I mean, certainly political media tends to be incredibly tedious because people are as tribal as you're talking about and just arguing in bad faith and not being very interesting. I don't know what those events, you know, what would prompt a reset? Is it, we've been through an economic crisis within recent memory. That didn't work. We've been through a terrorist bombing within memory. That didn't work. You know, we've been through a series of extremely contentious national elections. That hasn't worked. Does anybody have a, what's going to happen? Do we go back to Leary and the Brotherhood of Eternal Love and dose the entire water system of America with acid?
Well, if Michael Pollan has his way, we're on our way there. Yeah, so maybe that. Let's try for that.
I think we just need to call in. We just need to call in Christopher Nolan. He rebooted Batman. He can reboot America.
Yeah, but at what cost? That was a dark trilogy that is fucking great. But speaking of movies and TV and food, drink, whatever, we often end the podcast with recommendations or not recommendations, but just kind of discussions of what you're reading, what you're drinking, what you're listening to. Peter, why don't you get us started? What are you consuming in a cultural
I've spent the entire last month listening to an awful lot of interesting new hip-hop records. So Brian Doherty wrote about the new Kanye West record, Ye, which came out early in June. But that record was merely the centerpiece of a series of releases that Kanye West produced for a number of other artists, including Pusha T and Nas and a couple of others. And so I've been listening. It is a 5-album sequence. Each of the albums, except for the final one, has just 7 songs. So sort of 5 LPs. And it's really kind of a fascinating sort of almost kind of a multi-album, you know, sort of a multi-part single album, given that they were all released a week apart. And not all of them totally work, but he really is just an amazing, brilliant producer of sonic textures and sort of somebody who uses sound and rhythm in ways that you just don't hear in mainstream music. And then I would also add to the list of interesting hip-hop records, there's a new one from the Carters, that's Jay-Z and Beyonce. That's a pretty fun kind of summer showcase, especially for Beyonce's rapping talents. And then there is a new Drake album that came out last Friday, and it is also this extended take. It is a 25-song, 90-minute, 2-volume record, a kind of almost like a prog rap album. And it's fascinating. It is just...
He settles all the scores with Degrassi.
Drake has been doing a lot of score settling and beefing, in particular with Pusha T recently. Yes. But this album is, as his albums tend to be, kind of introspective. And it is just a kind of amazing... The production on it is so luxurious. And so it feels just like... I don't know, it's like if you've ever touched like a really nice leather chair and just thought, oh my goodness, this is just like what cows did they kill to, I don't really.
Who the fuck slipped the acid to
just
Peter kind of
you just agreed that we're going to do a national experiment in microdosing. I think Peter started
experience. The new Drake album is really amazing.
Do you see any necessary connection between your aesthetics and your political ideology?
To the extent that there is one, I don't know that it's necessary, but I often sort of wonder if more of my kind of hard-coded priors are actually aesthetic than political or ideological. And that I have stronger sometimes opinions about like what good aesthetics are versus what good politics are.
I know that deep down Debbie Harry agrees with me on everything in politics. But Catherine, what are you consuming?
Are you ready for the far, far other end of our spectrum on these recommendations?
I'm very ready.
My beach reading.
You are building a wire mesh monkey to feed your children so that you can just have a couple weeks
I'll
off.
Have you know, my children are at farm camp right now, and it is wholesome as hell. My beach reading is Progress and Poverty by Henry George, a big hit from the 1890s, friends. And it's...
God, and you're going to turn, you know, when I took over Reason, David Bose of the Cato Institute tried to slag me in conversation in front of common donors and said something like, I hear you're turning Reason into a lifestyle magazine because I like culture. And Catherine, are you turning us into a Georgist single tax magazine? Yep. Damn it.
You figured me out, Nick. I shouldn't have been away the game. I am going
Congress
to
a
conference in which this is required reading, just in, I don't know whether it's in my defense or not. But I'm actually finding it really fascinating. And the question which the book grapples with is like, why is it in a rich industrialized society that there seem to be people who are poorer and suffering more than ever? That's relevant to my interests. So,
wow.
Henry George.
And contemporary America. Wow. Damon, what about you? What are you grokking?
Well, I mean, out there in your fields
where you fight for
Catherine
your meals.
Catherine certainly made me want to revisit the Henry George attacks on Herbert Spencer. Spencer started out as a single taxer and then changed his view because he thought it would basically require socialism. And George, you know, went after him viciously. So that's like Drake
and Pusha T, right?
I have been revisiting some of the classics of the great metal band Pantera in tribute and mourning to the great drummer Vinnie Paul Abbott, who passed away last week. They were one of the soundtrack bands for my misspent teenage years. I saw them many times in Florida and a bunch in New York. And I also had the chance to meet Vinnie Paul. Friends of mine were on tour with Pantera summer of 99, part of the big Ozfest metal rolling summer tour. And so I met him and his brother backstage and hung out with them a little bit. And they're super cool guys, very nice. And so it's a sad day for metalheads everywhere.
Do you see any connection between your aesthetics and your ideology?
Only that they're kind of all unpopular.
Hey, how come you didn't ask me, man?
Well, because you're reading Henry George.
Sorry.
I'm going to come back to you. Just okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
God. No, but so do you, Damon, do you see aesthetics and ideology blending into one great blur for you?
No, and I prefer to, you know, keep some wall of separation there. But I mean, to the extent that it's all stuff that most people don't like, I guess there's a similarity in that way.
Can I ask for a sort of fair weather metalhead if you quit Pantera after Great Southern Trendkill, what should I come back to? Like, what's the album that I should spend more time with after that?
I mean, that's kind of the masterpiece. The one with Revolution Is My Name on it. I can't think of what the name of that record is. That might be the title of it. That's got some good tracks. But you know, it's the second, third, fourth albums are the best of their work.
Hmm. Catherine, what about you? Because I tend to see a continuity between my aesthetics and my ideology. I like deconstructive literature in general and art. I like art that kind of destroys itself in front of you or gives you the thread that you can pull on to show how it was created, how it has its effects. And I actually see that a real connection with my politics, which I like public choice theory, which is politics without romance in James Buchanan's phrase. And I like people who show the means of power rather than, kind of hiding or eluding them. So And I the person that I'm listening to right now is Frank Turner. I'll just, and then we can close with your comments on this. I'm listening to Frank Turner's great new record, Be More Kind, and I'm also reading his tour diary book, The Road Beneath My Feet, which came out a couple of years ago. And Reason TV's Meredith Bragg had set up an interview with this guy. He's a British post-punk folky who is a balls-out libertarian who went to the London School of Economics, where Hayek taught and Mick Jagger learned how to make money on tour. And he's huge in England, and he's like the bizarro Billy Bragg, which I've been looking for my entire life. And he's touring in the U.S. But I, you know, and I started listening to him because his ideology matches mine, and I like his aesthetics. I mean, I see this all the time, and don't we all want to project onto, you know, our favorite artist or our favorite writer or our favorite celebrity, like some similarity?
So as someone who recommended a new Netflix rom-com for last week's and Henry George for this week's, I think we might be hinting at my answer here, which is no. I don't think that politics and aesthetics should be connected, among other things. I think if we want people...
Well, I'm not saying they should be connected.
Or mine or not, and I think it's good that they aren't, because I don't think that we should... generate the feeling, which, you know, most famously in my pantheon was generated by Ayn Rand, that if you're not all in on the right Rachmaninoff or the right Pantera album, that you can't be part of the political club. And I think that's important, that we want to, you know, politics is about evangelism and aesthetics needn't be, although they frequently are. And that... you know, if we did set up a libertarian aesthetic pantheon, about half the stuff that I love would be ruled right out. But that, you know, that I think the thing that
I
is connected...
I have the worst fucking taste in the world.
The thing that
so
is connected...
I agree with you.
Is that I feel a genuine sort of joy and cheer and optimism about the just total flood of weirdness and greatness and trashiness and everything in between that's out there. And that I think it's connected to my politics. It makes me happy when there's the kind of bad things out there that other people like.
But I think we can all agree that Set It Up is objectively the most libertarian rom-com.
Yeah, definitely not.
Well, we are going to leave it there today. Best wishes to Matt Welch and his liver down in New Orleans. I would drag the canals if you can't find your liver on any given morning, Matt. I want to thank Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Damon Root for participating today. And I want to remind folks that there's still time to sign up for Freedom Fest, the world's largest annual gathering of libertarians. It's taking place in Las Vegas from July 10th to 14th. And we're celebrating the Reason Media Awards and Reason's 50th anniversary there on Saturday night. Here's my lock of the week, which is a really shitty sportscasting motif. Reason will be all over Freedom Fest like inflation on a fiat currency. Please subscribe to the Reason Podcast at iTunes, at Google Play or Google Podcasts or wherever you want to listen to us, and get us on a regular basis. Rate and review us while you're there. This has been the Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm Nick Gillespie.